Welcome to the Atom Ventures podcast. My name is Bhairav Patel. I'm here with Toby Muse, who's out in Washington, D.C. at the moment. Say hello, Toby.
Hey, Bhairav. Thanks for having me on your podcast. It's a pleasure to be here.
And Toby has just recently released a new book called Kilo, Life and Death Inside the Secret World of the Cocaine Cartels. And obviously for my regular listeners, this is not one of those tech or business podcasts. This is actually one that's very dear to me because Toby and I have been friends for many years, and I did manage to sneak a read of the book before it was launched. And this is a fascinating story, and Toby's work has just been phenomenal over the last number of years. And I feel that the podcast should be used to promote what he's been doing. So we're going to talk a little bit about Toby's past, his book, and really what he sees the future for Colombia and the fight against the war on drugs. So, Toby, can you start off giving us a little bit about telling us a little bit about yourself and your background? How did you get started as a journalist?
Well, firstly, thank you for that kind introduction. Indeed, we have been friends for many years, and it's a pleasure to be here talking to you. We met at university. I went to the London School of Economics. There were two books I can remember that really made me want to be a journalist. I remember reading Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas by Hunter S. Thompson, which was kind of, it just engaged me, the energy of the writing. And then when I was there at university, I read a book for a story, for a course on the history of the Middle East, Pity the Nation by Robert Fisk. And that's what made me want to be a foreign correspondent. So immediately I kind of just put all of my energies as soon as like my last year of university into how do I get to become a foreign correspondent.
Those are big names to live up to.
Exactly. Indeed. Indeed. I wouldn't even like to imagine measuring myself compared to them. But and so I wanted to move, and I decided I wanted to move to Latin America. I had a passing interest there. I wanted to be a foreign correspondent in Latin America. I first moved to Argentina. But I was that wasn't what I wanted. It was too normal. The idea of being a foreign correspondent to me involved war, a civil conflict. And Colombia was at the nadir of this violence at the moment, this deep drug war mixed with an ongoing civil conflict between Marxist rebels, far right death squads, and the central government. And so that's where I ended up. And that's where really my career began.
So can you set the scene a little bit? What year did you go out to Colombia, and what was it like when you were first there? I mean, what attracted you to that story in particular in South America?
Well, I had traveled to Colombia previously. I'd stayed in the principal regions of Medellin, Bogota, Cartagena, and as a tourist, because I had heard from so many other people. When I had backpacked 2 years earlier through Central America. I had met so many people coming out of Colombia on this well-established backpacker trail, and they were just raving about Colombia. I didn't have time. So I went on holiday the next summer while I was still at university, and I loved it. It was great people. It was just this phenomenal experience of just people living in spite of the violence, but it felt like life was more extreme because of the violence. And that was very attractive. So I get there, and you know, Colombia doesn't let you down. It's this intense experience. And when I got there, it really was the absolute lowest point, I would say. That it was the kidnapped capital of the world. There were massacres daily. And it was just this country struggling to get by, but kind of stuck in this spiral of violence. And so, yeah, I started working there and, you know, meeting the people who were fighting in the violence, but also trying to stop the violence. And I, you know, it just kind of, it got in me this desire and this to experience seeing people living at the extreme. You see the best of people, but unfortunately you also see the worst of people. And that's kind of been something throughout my career I've kind of drifted towards, whether it be going to Syria or Iraq, because it is amazing to see people doing good surrounded by chaos.
So how easy was it for you to set up? Because for the listeners out there, Toby is white man, quite tall, top white man. You rocking up to Colombia, you'd stand out a little bit. How do you actually, you know, involve yourself in this story? Because you are, for all intents and purposes, a true outsider, right?
I mean, that works both ways because, A, Colombians are very, very warm to foreigners. They were even warmer before this because they had no tourism industry whatsoever at that point. So they were very welcoming, very thankful almost, especially once you got out into the countryside, because these people in these dangerous parts of the countryside with the prospect of a massacre, the prospect of a bombing or a kidnapping would kind of understand. They would be like, wow, this foreigner has taken a risk to come out and report this story. There's also something I think about being the outsider that I've noticed again over the course of my career that I think applies to a lot of places. If you are an outsider, people who feel marginalized and excluded from the rest of society may be more open to speaking to you because they don't see you as the person who's been messing with them, oppressing them, keeping them down all their lives. So I felt like I could go into slums easier than, say, perhaps the university-trained Bogotano reporter, because that he or she is part of the system that has screwed them over. And I think that would apply, by the way, going into London. I think going into places that really feel excluded, I feel a Colombian journalist might get more out of it than, say, I might. Because if you're
a neutral observer, essentially, you're a neutral storyteller.
Exactly. I'm not bringing in a history of, like, denying them something or, you know, screwing them over or something. It really is, oh, I've got nothing against you. And I really do believe. And so it really wasn't a hindrance. And a final thing, on the whole, Colombia's violent haven't really messed with the international press so much. I think they just don't want to do it because it will bring them so much of a headache. Colombian journalists, they've slaughtered at the drop of the hat. And those are the really, truly brave journalists, especially the ones who work for community radio stations out in the countryside where they're just really alone. And they've paid a high price. The foreign journalists, basically, you know, we get warnings. If someone's really unhappy, they'll give a warning. And, you know, but on the whole, people don't mess with foreign journalists.
So obviously, you know, I mean, I think, well, I followed the stories there for a number of years, and you can see what's going on from the outside. But when you're there on the inside, and when you first started out, was it, you know, how you expected it to be? What was that experience like? Was it, I mean, obviously, I'm reading the book, tells that full story, but your initial impressions, let's say your first 6 months, 12 months, how did that hit you when you got there?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, no, it certainly was. It was intense. It was a country that had one of the highest homicides in the planet. It's still to this day, it's still violent, but it's certainly not as violent. It's certainly massively improved from what it was. But it's a violence that touches everybody. No family, not one person doesn't have a story of extreme violence, a friend of a friend, never further than that, you know, and actually never even that. Every family has someone who's died, I would say, or a friend, very close friend who's died in violent circumstances. Violence has just been a part of that country's history. You know, if you go back to the 1940s, they had this civil war that was so bloody, so unnameable. They just called it the violence, la violencia. That's it. That's all they call it because it's such horror. But in my first 6 months, first year, yeah, it was this great experience. You know, it's hard to talk about because in ways without being misunderstood, because it was horrific what I was seeing. But at the other time, it gave you a feeling of being a foreign correspondent, which are two dueling, conflicting emotions, because you do want to be a foreign correspondent because you want a life of adventure, but you also want your work to mean something. You want people's lives to be improved by it. But unfortunately, this job can somehow get involved in, the worst part of this job can be when people just end up chasing the adrenaline.
So I want to set the scene a little bit, because obviously we're going to talk about Kilo, but really what I would like to do, because a lot of, you know, people who you talk to, when I've talked to them about what you're doing, they initially go to Narcos and Pablo Escobar. Can we set the scene a little bit and talk a little bit about the true nature of the violence out there? Because one of the stories I know that you and I talked about some years back was where there was a paramilitary leader that you reunited with a daughter of a person that he had killed. And I like that. Well, I don't like that story, but it's an interesting story to tell simply because it just sets the scene of true brutality that was there. So if you could spend a couple of minutes just talking about that, so we can give the listeners a little bit of a feel of what you were stepping into.
Sure. So this was a paramilitary leader. His name was Francisco Villalba, and he was imprisoned. He was already in prison when I knew him. He was this child of the violence. He had been recruited in his teenage years. This is very, very common. They look for kind of marginalized, excluded, very poor kids. He was brought on by the far-right paramilitaries and kind of raised in that. They became his family. And he ended up killing in the Civil War. He didn't even know how many people. I asked him once. So he's then captured, and then he's in prison. He's in the maximum security prison. I meet him. And it comes up with this idea of, you know, would he meet, he had expressed to me a desire to ask for forgiveness to the daughter of a man he killed in a very famous massacre called El Aro, this tiny little mountain town. And so I contacted the daughter, and she had tremendous reservations about it. And so over time, we brought them together for a meeting, and he expressed his sorrow. And he had killed, this massacre was really phenomenally brutal. The woman was raped, there was 15 people killed, and it was one of those horrible ones where they took their time. He had overseen the torture of her father. It wasn't a quick death, it was a torturous death. So she meets him in this prison, and she refuses to forgive him. And I think she made the right decision, because I was the innocent one in this thing, and it took me years to understand this. He was a true psychopath, and what he was able to do was he was able to dangle in front of people what he would detect they wanted. He saw in me someone who was blinded to everything except this story of a killer who wants redemption. And he saw that, and he played me like that, and he got to the daughter of his victim, and he couldn't play her. With all of his manipulation, he couldn't do it. And with him, I learned something, which was I was searching through him to understand the violence. And I think I did, but not in the way I thought I was. It's chaotic. It means nothing. There is no reason for it. It's just a pulsating black heart at the center of it. There's nothing else there. There's no way to explain it. There's nothing to be learned there. It's just total negativity. And it took me years to understand that about Francisco. Francisco's life it's quite kind of funny. He started talking about possibly the intervention of the former president, or the president, sorry, at the time, President Álvaro Uribe. He started saying, well, he was involved in planning the massacre. And then Villalba was detected some sort of, I think it was leukemia in him. And so in a kind of strange move, the prison released him, which they don't really do for a maximum security prisoner like that. Villalba lasted 10 days before he was murdered on the streets of Medellin. And that was the end of that story.
Yeah. So, I mean, obviously, that's a very powerful story. And I think that sets the tone for what we're about to discuss now. So obviously, there will be some who have read Kilo, many who I believe will not have. So can you just describe in your own words the book and the story you're about to tell?
So, yeah, I've moved out of Colombia and I wanted to write this kind of book. I felt there had been too many books that kind of retrace the history of these people that we now know the outlines of their life. We don't need another book about Pablo Escobar. Everybody, if you're interested, you know that story. What I wanted to do, but I felt what these books missed was that bringing the reader into the moment of what it feels like to be in the middle of the war on drugs, the madness, the thrill, the danger, how grimy it is, how treacherous it is, how sexy it can be. All of this, there's all of these different faces of cocaine, and that might make some people uncomfortable to be saying that. But the truth is, this is a business of murder, sex, and money. That's why it attracts so many people. And I wanted to take the reader and put them right in there. And this is what it feels like. And for the reader to get to know the people at the center of this business. So the book meets the drug trafficker, meets the killer for hire, meets the drug trafficker's girlfriend, his witch who casts spells, the police who are trying to stop this drug, the police, the Coast Guard out in the seas. And the conceit of the book is to follow one kilo from its production in the jungles all the way as it's exported out of the country.
So I think once you read the book, you understand the level of access that you managed to obtain. And you were talking to, you know, essentially murderers and drug cartel leaders. How did you get that access? How was that? I mean, obviously that takes time and obviously a lot of skill. How did you manage to do that?
Well, I mean, I should divide it up into two. So when you get out into the countryside and you're interviewing the people who are actually the first stages of this, the coca farmers, the coca pickers, that's actually relatively easy if you're a journalist to get to those. You have to try to get to those zones. I think it's important to understand, for your listeners to understand this. You won't go to Bogota on holiday, take a wrong turn stepping out of your hotel, and suddenly you're in the middle of the drug war. No, it doesn't work like that. To get to these places, you have to really go to these forgotten corners of the country. To give you an idea, where we were staying for the coca pickers, it took 6 hours from the closest major town. And that town itself is like 25,000 people. And it took 6 hours crossing on a ferry, going down a path on a motorbike. But those people are quite open to journalists because they feel they want to explain to the world. They want people to understand, look at how we live. We don't have an alternative. So that part is relatively easy. You can speak to community leaders. They'll facilitate the journey. Of course, they also, you have to dodge the narco militias who often kidnap, but you choose your timing. You know, if they haven't kidnapped people for a while, you go in, do your research and get out before. The cartel people are much harder, obviously. They don't have any interest in speaking. This comes about because I met someone. It's kind of funny the way life works. This was probably about 10, 11, 12 years ago. I met someone who I was going to a fashion show, and there was a guy with two women who was trying to get in via the kind of PR way, the media entrance. And there was this woman with the clipboard, and I really just, these people really annoy me, those people with clipboards who say no, no, no. And, you know, he was trying to get in, and I said, oh, no, they're with me. I'm with the international press, they're with me. And she said, oh, okay, everyone can go in. And the guy said to me, hey, look, you know, thanks for that, I owe you a favor. And it turned out that he was involved in the social life of the cartels, that he operated in these parties where the drug lords go out partying, the parties that can go for 3, 4, 5 days. And his job in that was connecting these models and actresses with the drug lords. So he was this valued friend of a lot of drug traffickers. And over the years, we became, you know, friends. And through him, I met a lot of other people who would then lead on to other people. And I, you know, you start off lower down, you do a few stories, and they see that they can trust you, and so they open up.
So one of the things I find quite fascinating about the way that you tell the story, because you do introduce a lot of just crazy characters and people that you shouldn't really empathize or sympathize with. And I find myself actually sympathizing and empathizing with some horrendous people. And you're thinking, because obviously you humanize them to an extent, and how did you feel when you're there talking to someone that you know has murdered maybe hundreds of people and the person that is sitting next to him who's ordered those murders? You know, how was that? Did you disassociate yourself from all of this? I mean, how was it to tell this in such a kind of empathetic manner?
I mean, journalism, sometimes when you're interviewing people like that, it can be like, it's hard to put into words, but it's almost like you're a magician and you're just keeping the person you're interviewing engaged in the interview. It's kind of using manipulation, sleight of hand, anything just to keep them speaking, to keep getting the answers to the questions I want answered. So it is this kind of thing of you're being, I mean, that's the funny thing when you see people say, well, if I interviewed that drug lord, I would tell, way, what are you? No, you wouldn't, because you wouldn't even get to that idea of sitting down with the drug lord. You come in with your, that's this person just immediately gets up. It's this kind of, and walks out. What you need to keep them sitting there, and you kind of, you're using your charm to keep them answering. It's like being a snake charmer. And it's not so much, obviously you're worried about what they're going to tell you in terms of, the worst thing that could happen to me is I'm speaking to a drug lord, we're talking, he goes home, he's lying in bed, he's looking at the ceiling and says, you know what, I really shouldn't have told that journalist that. Oh, well, I better tie up the loose end. So I didn't want to hear anything about future crimes. I didn't want to hear anything specifically about specific crimes that then they would regret telling me. So we were always talking in generalities, and that was important for my own safety. These men and women live in a world of violence. There's just this heavy dread around them. Everything, they give off these auras of violence. And it's heavy, you know, it's heavy to be around them. And when I finished this book, and it just felt like a weight coming off my shoulders, because these are men who will kill at the drop of a hat. They don't need, you know, I mean, that's the way they live. That's how that business operates. When it came to writing, I wanted to show why they did the things they did, but I didn't want to be overly sympathetic. That was important for me, because I didn't want to justify them, because, you know, these have killed innocent people, because that's part of the business.
Yeah, and I think you do. There's a very balanced way of doing it. The sense that you get is that once they're in, they really want to get out. So there is that period of time where, you know, everything is sexy and wonderful and they've got the women and the cars and the drugs, and then they realize, well, hang on, how do I get out of this?
It's impossible. Exactly. And that's what really fascinated me about it. Everybody came up with roughly the same story. And it all goes down to this thing. It is a handshake with the devil. You think you're smarter than the devil? Cocaine is smarter than you. You think you're using cocaine? No, she's using you. She's like an organism. She just wants to get out. She wants to be consumed. She'll use anybody. And they think they're winning. No, she's winning. She's bought you. And you will suffer because she uses people. And then she uses them up. Take the famous, most famous drug trafficker ever, Pablo Escobar. It was cocaine that destroyed him. Because once he declared war on Colombia in his effort to stop the extradition, so drug traffickers being sent to the US to stand trial and go to prison, he declared war on Colombia. He interrupted the cocaine business. So cocaine got together, unified against him, and brought him down. No one ever beats cocaine.
So what do you think it is about the drug that causes this? Because you don't see the same thing with, you know, alcohol or meth or nicotine or smoking. Well, I guess smoking is slightly different. But, you know, when you talk to the farmers, you talk to the people who are cutting the coca leaves, you talk to the killers, you talk to the, you know, the drug traffickers, none of them, all of them are asking for, in a way from the book, the sense is that they're all asking for a way out or asking them to be able to do something different to earn the same money. But they can't. So is that it? Is it purely a monetary thing, or is there something else about the drug that keeps them locked in?
Again, there's different stages, and I think there's different desires. So when you do look at the farmers, these people are desperate to get out. I've never seen them so desperate, because they've spent now a whole generation in cocaine. They know they've seen the best of it, and that's not coming back. And to give you an example, because of what's happening, their farmers are getting paid for a kilo of coca paste, which is how they've turned the leaves into this material that's one step short of pure cocaine. They sell it in kilos. They're receiving the same price for that kilo of coca paste that they received 15 years ago. Why? Because narco militias now control that part of the business. So they force the farmers to sell them at this price. 15 years ago, there was more of an open market. So people would come in and they would bid for it. So now the farmers say, well, I have all of the downside of living in coca, which is massive violence. Violence is always the norm in this business. You live under the rule of the narco militias. There's a social decay because cocaine has this kind of nihilism, and the prostitutes turn up. So families kind of break apart. The 60-year-old farmer decides he's going to run off with the 19-year-old prostitute. STDs go up through in these villages. Cocaine is a downer on these farming towns that in the past led these quiet, dignified lives of coffee or cattle. When cocaine comes in, it's social chaos. So anyway, they've seen the worst. They're living through the worst. So I spoke to them. They all want out. The best way of doing this, the way we know works, is when the government works with the farmer, gives them a stipend. There was a plan that they were doing for 2 years. A stipend every month, small stipend to get them by. And 2 one-off payments for projects to get your new company up and running, cattle, coffee, whatever. And the government just lost interest. But we know 99% of people who successfully end that program don't return to coca. When you're talking about fumigation, these planes that fly over the coca fields, a massive amount of them return to coca because they don't have any options. You know, you've destroyed their crops. Now they need to get out. So those people do want to go out. When you talk about the people in the cartels, again, one of the reasons why I wanted to write this book is because when you write a book which has graphs and statistics, you're not acknowledging the human passions that beat at the heart of this. Sex is central to the world of cocaine. Sex and cocaine have been there from the beginning. Sigmund Freud would write letters to his girlfriend at the time saying, we will see how you won't be able to fight me off, a big man filled with cocaine. I mean, it's been there. You know, when you look at the 20s and that whole, what was it, Cole Porter song, some people get a kick out of champagne, I get a kick out of you. One of the lines is some people get a kick out of cocaine. Cocaine has always been this kind of, we've decided it's the glamorous drug. It's the drug of glamour. It's the drug of the economic boom. It's the drug that makes the young executive makes them feel like they've made it. It was the drug of the 80s in Wall Street. It was the drug of Russia in the 90s with the oligarchs. It's the drug of the Asian entrepreneurs who are becoming millionaires right now. So it's always had this glamorous side. So these men and women got into that. The criminals get into it for the sex, for the money. But when they're in it, they realize that they're trapped and they see no way out. With the criminals, you know, it's difficult to know what other life paths they could have taken, you know.
So that you talk a lot about the glamour, and I think that's the key. That's what most people associate with cocaine, right? And again, when you have Netflix series like Narcos and all of the different programs that are around it, you got to get that sense of you know, the glamour that entices people into using it and obviously, you know, buying it and selling it. So what is the answer in that sense? Because if you glamorized it, it's hard to break that kind of hypnosis, essentially, that's there. And obviously many, many people want to get out, but how do you break that cycle?
I mean, I don't know. And yes, it's a strange one. And because obviously I've just thought nothing but cocaine for the last 2 or 3 years. It's a strange one that we collectively, no one does advertising for cocaine, but cocaine has this enviable position in our collective consciousness, that it is the drug of glamour. It's the sexy drug. It's the drug of a model in New York, an actor in Los Angeles. Again, no one does that, but you would kill if you had a kind of edgy product. You would kill to have that as your image. But somehow we've collectively decided it is there. How can you stop it being glamorous? I don't know. I know that the many agencies of Colombia want to do that. They want to start a campaign to really show that it comes out of this grimy beginnings. I mean, that was another thing. When I was standing in this laboratory watching them, produce cocaine, I mean, this ain't Breaking Bad. You know, it's not like these pristine laboratories and judged to the milligram. No, it's like them throwing some gasoline onto it, throwing the leaves in a vat of gasoline.
Which is an amazing thing, right? I think that's what most people don't realize, is that the amount of gasoline is, it's guys see a farmer in the middle of the jungle in like wellies.
Oh, yeah. Gasoline, right? And they're treading up and down on the leaves to kind of mulch in the chemicals. Like, you know, when you see the Italian grandmothers on top of the grapes, they're doing that kind of stuff. They're throwing ammonia on, then the acids are thrown in there. I mean, it's kind of, you know, maybe if people saw how it was produced, it would be unglamorized. It would lose its glamour. But then sometimes you think some things are inherently, one of my favorite books in journalism is a book called Dispatches, and that was a massive inspiration for me. Michael Herz reporting for Esquire magazine in Vietnam in like 1969. And I wanted to write the dispatches of the drug war to kind of just show how mad this is. How, again, to recite the cliche, the definition of madness, doing the same thing and expecting a different result. That's what we're doing with the drug war. We keep doing the same thing. And there's now more cocaine than ever, much more than in the time of Pablo Escobar. But part of that is there's a night where Michael Herd talks about a new reporter coming into Vietnam. And he said, yeah, I've come here and, you know, I want to take the glamour out of war. And Michael Herd and his colleagues burst out laughing, because you can't take the glamour out of war. These may be uncomfortable truths, but young men in particular are very attractive to many of these things. They find it glamorous. They find life on the edge very glamorous. And that's why, you know, young men rush off to war. You can't take the glamour out of war.
So I was going to ask a question as to whether you see this as a battle between good and evil, but it's not really that. It's much more complicated than that, isn't it, really? There is very little good, and there is just only evil in many senses. And okay, evil may be a bit strong term, but in many ways it is, right? It's some of the people there can describe as evil.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's part of it. I mean, certainly the drug trafficker I write about him, that if you're not going to, if you won't use the word evil for a man like that, then just scrub that word from the dictionary. And I think, you know, that we can't explain everything. And I think these words are useful, because when you see a lonely community leader standing up to death squads and or rebels and just saying, no, I'm going to do what's correct, and they just can't help themselves. You have to say this person is a hero. This person is just good. And when you see someone who, you know, their life is killing people who stand in this way, then, yeah, you can use the word evil. You can understand how they came about, but you never want that understanding to cross that invisible line where it becomes explaining away. And that was, it was a constant stress for me that throughout writing this book. I mean, yeah, I think we are due for an honest conversation about these drugs, about our drug policy. You know, because look, do you doubt that anyone has trouble in London getting cocaine? You know, obviously with the lockdown, that's changed things. But are you hearing from friends in New York that, oh my God, no one can get drugs? I'm hearing the reverse, that there's more drugs than ever. This is after the UK, the US has spent billions giving aid to Colombia. Colombia has, tens of thousands of people have died in these drug wars. And still we're at more cocaine than ever. I'm not sure I have the solution, but I know what we're doing is wrong. That I can say 100%.
So from all the people that you've met whilst writing this book, is anyone that you just wanted to kind of pick up and take out of that world and just say, look, I'm going to help you get out?
God, yeah. I mean, the coca pickers were all Venezuelan migrants. You feel really bad for them. They were in such good spirits because they had a job, but they had literally walked across into the country, leaving the economic madness of Venezuela, where you starve, you go to bed hungry, there's not even basic medicine. There was a Venezuelan prostitute who I interviewed in a brothel who was just kind of overwhelmed by the kind of violence, because she was living in the heart of the drug war in this town called La Guevara, which is this coca town, and just everything runs on coca. So if any of you have, like, imagine what the Wild West, those gold rush towns of Deadwood, that HBO series. If you imagine that, that's what this town is. There's no law. It's only the law imposed by the narco militias. There's like three different narco militias fighting for control of this tiny town. They fight for control because there's money to be made out of the coca. She was just kind of, she just had the look of, she was in shock. I felt bad for, there was a gang member who was really interesting, and he really was very bitter about the con he felt that the life of crime had promised him. He must be in his 20s, and he told me, he said, you know who's worth something? A man who works hard all week, a man who works hard all week, saves money for his family, and is able to take his family out on Sunday for an ice cream. That man is worth something. I'm worth nothing. And that was, you know, I was like, Jesus. I mean, this was a really eloquent gang member. But he said, it's too late for me. I'm stuck in it. And then he said, look, if I could get money for a motorbike, I could be a messenger. That's also something, I think, something people don't understand. On the lower rungs of the crime of the underworld, these people have such small dreams, but in a country where wealth and political power is so concentrated, even those are impossible.
So what I find interesting, you mentioned the Venezuelan, is that some of those guys that you talked to were well-educated and coming in and then just picking leaves, right? And then it kind of sucked in people who you wouldn't expect necessarily. Wasn't one working in police force or?
Yeah, I mean, he was a lunatic. I mean, he was a genuine lunatic. But he had been involved in, so there's this horrific thing in across much of South America, and it's called social cleansing. And basically what it is the undesirables, and I'm doing air quotes here, undesirables of a town. The police will be out of uniform. Off-duty policemen will come together in a gang, and then they'll kill them, and they'll receive money from shopkeepers. So we're talking about, say, a very violent or aggressive crack addict who robs people, prostitutes who have a reputation for ripping off clients. Those are muggers, street criminals like that. So he was heavily involved in this, he was telling me. And then he told me that they were just killing so many of these criminals. And eventually they tried to kill one neighborhood drug dealer. He didn't die. He let the force know. So this group of four of them, they all scattered across the continent. And here he was picking coca. Another one was a bank employee. Now, I mean, imagine that. He seemed to come from humble enough origins. Had obviously just put in all of his time, had studied hard, And there he was working in a bank. Venezuelan society collapses all around him. And now he's in a field in Colombia picking coca. I mean, talk about ups and downs of life, man. Get your head around that one.
No, that's pretty crazy. One of the things actually I wanted to get my head around is a couple of situations you found yourself in where you essentially felt, you know, you feared for your life. So why did you put yourself into those situations? I guess in some ways those situations happened to you, but, you know, was there a moment in any part of this journey, this experience, where you just said, right, that's it, I want to get out now?
Oh, God, constantly. Just constantly. I mean, it's weird to describe the difference between, so when you go to Iraq or Syria and you're going to a front line and it's a hot front line of two opposing armies, there's a kind of sense of, all right, you go in and then you leave. So it's a kind of limited window of time and it's full on adrenaline. You're jumping around, you're ducking and diving, you're running and everything. And the adrenaline takes over. When you're dealing in the underworld, it's a never ending dread. So it's not that everyone's shooting guns off all around you. It's just, it could happen at any moment. And so there were a number of cases when, I mean, I thought at one moment they thought I may have communicated with the police, and this guy I had known for years came around to my hotel, and it was a bad scene. And I took a knife and I was like, you know, I'm just going to do what I can to anyone who tries to grab me, but I'm not going to let myself be taken away. I put myself in that position. I tried to avoid the more extreme situations, but I felt, you know, it's always going to happen when you're dealing with very, very violent criminals like this. You're always going to have a few scares. That's, you know, that's part of the...
So you mentioned your time in Syria, just in Iraq. I guess we are talking about Colombia, but let's just talk a little bit about that. And you went from, I think you came from London and then went straight to Syria via Turkey, right? How was that experience? I mean, how was that compared to being in the jungles of Colombia, then deserts of Syria?
Well, I mean, Colombia is a much lower. So here's the thing. I mean, Syria was just shockingly easy to get to a front line. Like, I kept on thinking, man, there should be someone here to stop me doing this. So I went in. So basically, I flew to flew from London to Istanbul, and then flew from Istanbul to this beautiful town. If anyone gets a chance, go to this city called Gaziantep. And it has these phenomenal old ruins from the Roman Empire. Just stunning, beautiful, great, great city. So went there and then drove to a small town, which was called Kilis, which essentially you're in the Middle East at this point. I mean, Kilis is, you know, Turkey is this really interesting, it's the kind of crossroads of the world, right? If you ignore the new world of the Americas. But it's like, it connects everything. When you are in Kilis by the Syrian border, you're in the Middle East. You know, there's no more crossroads of the world. No, you're in the Middle East. So we were on the border there. And what you would do is, they had the rebels controlled that checkpoint, that border crossing. So I crossed into Turkey, and there was always this kind of minivan. And I think he paid like $100. And he would do the 2-hour journey from Kilis to the hospital in Aleppo. And I was on that van, and I was like, you know, I've been in combat in Colombia. Look, this is going to be more intense, but I kind of know what I'm in for. The minivan pulls up in front of the hospital in central Aleppo. There's heavy shelling that seems like it's landing like 3 blocks, if that, from me. There's planes chucking bombs over on the other side of the city that I can see. The places I had to force myself to get out of that minivan and not just throw money at the driver and just say, take me home, this is madness. And I physically had to like summon all of the energy to grab my bag, get out of that minivan and go into that hospital. And that's where all of the foreign journalists were dropped off, because all of these different fighting militias, they were all separated. Remember, this was 2012. So, and these militias would just kind of take on a foreign journalist. They would say, hey, do you want to come with us? All right, yeah, fine. So I ended up with this, they called them Kativas, the militias. And so I stayed with the Kativa for weeks. And it was, there were times in it that still kind of almost bring tears to my eyes. Almost, I said, because there were men and women there who called themselves true revolutionaries who were fighting for something. And there was a town called Al-Abab, which declared itself the first free revolutionary town in Syria. And to see that city hall meeting of these men. It was all men. They promised they were going to try and change that. But to see them sitting there trying to address the city's problems, it was a satellite town outside of Aleppo. But it was inspiring. I mean, it was just seeing these. Unfortunately, the revolution eats its children. So I think all of those people who were there, who would call themselves, you know, were secular. It wasn't overtly religious all the time with these men and women. As the violence just got worse and worse and spiraled into madness, all of them either had to flee or were killed by ISIS. ISIS came in hunting for those, quicker than anyone. They called them secularists, and that was a death sentence in Syria. But at that moment, we were on the front lines, and you would see these jihadis. They would all be dressed up in black, but at that moment, they weren't hunting us, the foreigners. They didn't like us, and that was clear. And I had some run-ins with them. One tried to shoot me on the front line. Like, I'm like, man, seriously, why are you trying to shoot me? The Syrian soldiers who are trying to kill you, like 100 feet away, and you're trying to shoot me next to you. But it wasn't a policy on their part. Their distaste for us foreigners was obvious. But it wasn't policy on their part to kill us or to kidnap us. But I met incredible people in that hospital. I met this woman. Every day the Syrian government tried to destroy this hospital. Not every day, that's not true. But, you know, at least once a week there would be shelling would hit the hospital, or an airstrike would hit the building. But imagine the bravery of a woman, 21, 22, who I think, if I'm not wrong, was trained to be a veterinarian. But because so many medical people had fled the violence, imagine going to a building every single day. You know that someone is trying to physically destroy and gets hit once a week. That bravery is mind-blowing for me. I can do it if it's just running in and out. I'll do that. Oh, okay, I'm 2 weeks in Syria. That's great. She was looking to the foreseeable future and saying, every day I will go to this building that someone is trying to... That, to me, is astounding bravery. And the tragedy is that one day they destroyed it and she died. And that's heartbreaking. So and Syria will be hard.
No, go on, sorry.
No, that's it.
So how long did you actually spend in Syria in total?
I spent in Syria on and off around 6 months. I left because, again, the ups and downs of the news business. I left towards the end of 2012, early 2013. I think the end of 2012, which was about 4 months, I would say. I think I got there in early August. Yeah, that makes about sense. So I spent there pretty much all the time, either on the border or in Syria, all of that time. I left because I couldn't sell the stories anymore. It was getting more expensive to be in Syria, and the editors weren't commissioning as many stories. What we didn't really know, certainly I wasn't really putting it together, was how bad the situation of the kidnappings was becoming. And I think there was some problems there.
With the journalists?
The journalists were being kidnapped, and there's a natural inclination when someone gets kidnapped in order for the family. A lot of people will tell the family, look, when you get kidnapped, you have basically two options. You either your family runs to the rooftops and starts screaming about it, or you absolutely batten down the hatches and you say, no, the more publicity will drive the price up and could endanger them. Let's do this all quiet. So please understand me. There's no blame in what I'm saying. But I think many people were keeping incidents of kidnapping secret. And that means other people were going into zones without really understanding how bad it was. I think it's in 2013. I'll just speak for myself. I really understood. Oh, okay. There is a collective plan now to kidnap people. It is not just, oh, you had a stroke of bad luck and this militia leader figured he would do something. No, there is something more organized going on. And I left, and I know people have been, there have been a number of kidnappings. It felt like you had to look over your shoulder, but it didn't feel like, holy shit, this is, I can't manage this.
So in many ways, it was safer for you to be in Colombia than in Syria.
Oh, yeah, without doubt. I mean, Syria was nuts. I mean, Syria was mental. You would go to sleep. To give you an idea of how mental Syria was, you would go to sleep in these in these war zones that you've got to start imagining, you know, what Stalingrad looked like, right? Just these zones which were just bombed out, but that's where the militias lived. So they were entirely empty neighborhoods, except for where the militias lived. And then you would hear the shelling from the Syrian army. And what they would do is they would shell every sector of rebel-held territory in Aleppo. So you would hear, over the course of 2 hours, the shelling getting gradually ever closer to you. And it would get closer to you at, say, 2 o'clock in the morning. The shells would then be coming in so close that they would be rattling your windows. I never got a direct hit, but you think, my God, the next shell is going to be a direct hit. And these were from cannons being fired 20 kilometers away. I mean, Syria was mad. I think everyone just went, it turned everybody kind of mad, I would say. I mean, it was just, and I think, you know, just the nihilism of violence we would see expressed by, you know, those lunatics of ISIS, I think, you know, it's just one face of the madness of it.
So going back to Kilo, as we've been a bit distracted by your fascinating stories in Syria, what do you think the book will, what are you hoping the book will achieve?
I want a change to drug policy because I want Colombians to stop dying for this war on drugs. I just to sum it up, I don't know what the policy should be, but I know that what we're doing now is causing so many Colombians to die because of this drug war. And this is a country that is, you know, I lived 17 years in Colombia. I have very, very deep feelings, you know, for that country. I became a fully formed adult in that country. I love that country. I live this, it's endlessly beautiful country. It's filled with secrets. It has an amazing people. And it doesn't deserve this curse. And I want the drug war to change. I don't know what the options are. I don't. But I know what we're doing is not working. And it's just leading into more and more misery for so many people.
Yeah, and I think one thing you do very well is obviously highlight the plight of just ordinary people within this book and how, you know, as we mentioned before, they're unable to escape, but also it's just the way that it completely subsumes them as individuals.
Absolutely. And, you know, some of these ordinary people, I think that's also the thing in Colombia I kept coming up against, because when you live in an extreme environment, it, as well as giving an opportunity for evil, it gives an opportunity for the strong, the brave and the good to make a difference. And just to see so many men and women fighting against injustice. And, I mean, it was, you know, some of these people are inspiring because they're doing it. They feel like they're alone sometimes. It's not like, you know, here's the thing. If you live in Switzerland and you're a law-abiding citizen, so what? You live in a fully functioning state. You know that if you commit a crime, you will receive a punishment. In a place like Colombia, where it's such a free-for-all, when you are an honest, law-abiding citizen trying to do good, you don't have to do this, but you do it because you're just naturally, that's the way you've been brought up. These people are genuine heroes. The bravest, best people in my life I've ever met were in Colombia. Bye, Paul.
So a few questions, just a couple more questions left. So if there are any kind of budding journalists out there, obviously you started your career a while ago, people looking to get into the business at the moment, what would you recommend? What kind of thing, you know, what advice would you give them?
Wow, that's a hard one. I mean, the media at the moment it's just not working. You know, it's not working. I think the media is not going through a good time for various reasons. I feel like it's very stagnant. I don't think it's being particularly innovative in just the way it's presenting the news. I don't hear enough journalists really asking about how to keep the reader or the viewer engaged. I think that a certain level of partisanship has become more and more dull for many people. I think the career, there's nothing I ever wanted to be more than a foreign correspondent. That was the job for me. You could have offered me any job when I was 25. And any job on the planet, that's the job I wanted. So if you can make it work, but unfortunately, the deep, horrible secret now for so many people is that they receive support from their family or they support from their spouse. You shouldn't have to be subsidized to do this job, because it's an important job about reporting on different parts of the world and coming back and explaining things. If we had had a better media, maybe the election of Donald Trump and Brexit wouldn't have been such a surprise. But Donald Trump and Brexit certainly should not have been a surprise. That was media.
What you're trying to say is that the media needs to do their job of explaining things better to the population about what's going on in the world and how things fit together, right?
Yeah, and get out to those corners that perhaps you weren't reporting from. Because I know that the reporters who, I don't live in England, so I'm no expert on Brexit, but I know that the reporters who were trying to get to places like Grimsby in the run-up to that vote were saying, hold on, I think a surprise is coming. Whereas people in London were like, oh, well, you know, this is the end of Farage. Donald Trump was the same thing. You know, you had a New York-based media, and yeah, they didn't see what was happening in places like Michigan. So I think the media is doing a bad job. I don't think these are good days for the media. I think, you know, but being a foreign correspondent, unfortunately, again, another mistake, I would say, by the media is that they're devoting so much of their resources into covering Donald Trump. And so a lot of these foreign news budgets have been slashed. So it's hard. But I would say, just quickly, because I know people, if they are interested, they always want concrete advice. I would say learn to film, edit, write, produce, because I think that's the only way you can do that. You get a certain amount of money, you go off, you make a video piece, and you can write a story that you can sell as text. And the stories I would look for that I think certainly in Latin America, where you can make money, is Venezuela, is going to be a story where you can make money, and maybe the border. I think, you know, maybe we'll see more interest in the US-Mexican border. That's a world of just fascinating stories. You've got immigration, you've got the underworld, the Mexican cartels, you've got these cultural shifts of, as places like Texas become more and more Latino, how that's changing the culture. And just Texas is fantastic. El Paso is one of my favorite towns anyway. So that would be my concrete.
You spend a lot of time in the Amazon as well, though. So what do you think about the stories there in Brazil?
Yeah, I mean, definitely. You know, if you can go live in a place like Manaus, which is the biggest city in the Amazon, Manaus is a weird, wild place anyway, and you'll have a great time. I think these environmental stories are only going to become more and more important. I think the age of a lot of the... If you can go live in the Amazon, I'm not saying it's the easiest experience in the world, but if you can, because I think the age of when these news organizations would pay thousands of dollars on travel costs, I think those are over. They just don't have the money in many cases. So if you're on the ground and you can offer up those stories, and there will be another burning season when Brazilian farmers will slash and burn more of the Amazon, and it will be a very visual story. And
Yeah, I guess those days of Hunter flying first class are over. So what's your next story? What do you have in the pipeline?
Well, I'm working on a documentary about the coronavirus. We're in New York. We have just come back from there, and that was, you know, a very strange experience. I was out with a volunteer ambulance service. Just phenomenal, phenomenal people. And so I'll be working on that documentary. Then after that, I don't know, maybe I'll write a novel or something. I don't know. The world is wide open.
So last two questions. Firstly, for anyone who's read the book, what has happened? What happened to Manuela?
Manuela was a kinkajou. A kinkajou I rescued from an animal trafficker. Well, I bought from an animal trafficker. He had her in this cage and she was really suffering. And I bought her, and then I had planned to release her into the jungle. And then as soon as I hadn't really thought this through. And every Colombian told me, as I took her on this 6-hour journey and I would announce my plan, they said, well, you can't do that. She's been socialized with humans. She won't survive the jungle. So I ended up giving her to this, this general store out in the jungle. There's always a general store where all of the farmers go to it. And this had all dogs, cats, birds, parrots, and they just loved animals. So Manuela looked so happy there. So hopefully she's doing well.
Oh, you never checked up on her then?
I didn't get a chance, no. And it's hard to get back to that zone. That zone, if anything, is Catatumbo is the region it's called. And it has more lightning strikes than anywhere else on the planet. That's what Catatumbo means, land of lightning. Unfortunately, the security situation's got even worse there with the new narco militias, so it would be tough for me to get out there.
So, final question for you. If you could, and this is one I ask everyone on my podcast. So, if you go back in time 20 years and give advice to your younger self, what would that be? And don't say buy Bitcoin.
Trust me, not one of my answers is going to involve Bitcoin. I would say just take everything further. Take everything further, be more enthused. If you can't be enthusiastic about something, don't do it. Right. I'm one of those people who took a while to mature. I don't feel I matured until I was in my early 30s. I don't see enough people admitting that. I think I was very deeply immature in my 20s. And I think I was, and that I regret. I wish I'd been more mature earlier. I wish I had understood that life is to create. Life is to create things that you're proud of. And I think you look at society, that's when society's been best, when men and women have had roles creating things they are proud of. And I think much of this weirdness we're in today is because there's not enough people creating stuff. They're in, you know, so I wish I'd known that. Just take things further. Just really go in, dive in head first, 100%, and push it as far as you can take it.
That's interesting advice. Yeah. Very interesting. Okay, so the book is called Kilo, Life and Death Inside the Secret World of the Cocaine Cartels. I've been speaking to Toby Muse. Thanks a lot for that, Toby. It's been a pleasure speaking to you.
This has been great. I hope you invite me back on later and we can have another chat.
Definitely. Thanks.